Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, seeking accountability for last week's insurrection at the Capitol. House Democrats continue their push to remove President Trump from office by pressuring Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment while at the same time introducing an article of impeachment. More than 200 House Democrats back these efforts, and a handful of Republicans have said they'd sign on. But many conservatives claim impeaching Trump for a second time would only increase threats of violence. My guest, Yoni Applebaum, is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He argues impeachment may be just what the country needs now. He joined me Tuesday morning. Yoni, Nancy Pelosi has given Vice President Pence today to make up his mind as to whether to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office. If that does not happen, the House will tomorrow address and presumably pass a motion to impeach President Trump. In your mind, which would be the better avenue for the country?
I don't think there's any question that impeachment is the way forward here. The 25th Amendment was designed to deal with presidential incapacity. One can argue that Trump's abilities have incapacitated his ability to discharge his office, but it's really not intended to be and not set up as an adversarial process. There's all kinds of uncertainties that any attempt by Pence and the cabinet to remove the president would set off. The 25th Amendment really was designed for a president who has a stroke or a president who is otherwise sidelined. And if we saw a contest over who is in control of the American government, that would not be healthy at this moment of all moments. Whereas impeachment was designed precisely for a situation like this. It's a constitutional mechanism for ensuring that a runaway executive who is abusing his power, who is violating his oath of office, can be held to account by a co-equal branch of government. That's something that Congress, which has been fairly supine the last 4 years, has largely neglected, but now seems roused from its slumber.
And what does being held to account mean as far as this president is concerned?
Well, I think that's exactly the right question, and it gets to the nature of the impeachment process. It's not a criminal trial, although Congress, which is overpopulated with lawyers, tends to treat it like that. There may be many problems with having this many lawyers in Congress. One is that they think analogistically and they draw on their own experience and have tended to treat impeachment as if it were a criminal trial. But it's really not. It's a legislative body deciding whether or not a president is fit for the office that he holds. It doesn't trigger double jeopardy. So what it does is remove the president from office and potentially, if a majority of the Senate is so inclined, could bar him from holding future office. But it doesn't preclude a criminal trial on some of the charges which have led to the president's removal, nor does it require criminal offenses. Scholars are nearly unanimous about this, that impeachment was never about the criminality of a president. A criminal act could lead to impeachment. On the other hand, if a president hurts a hedge growing along the National Mall, that would be a violation of the U.S. federal code, but not an impeachable offense. There's always been this distinction, and it's not about punishing the president. It's about removing a man from an office that he cannot faithfully discharge, and then he can face whatever other criminal consequences or liabilities come his way or not. But it's really about trying to resolve a situation in which you have somebody in control of the government who is not fit to be in control of the government.
What about the suggestion that's been put forward that impeachment by the House and waiting for indictment by the Senate would have to come later, since we're just 8 days from the inauguration of Joe Biden, as you and I are speaking on this Tuesday morning, the 12th?
Well, Congress has encrusted itself with a lot of traditions that have slowed its ability to act in moments like these. There is no theoretical reason why the president could not be impeached and removed in a day or two. In 1868, when Congress was facing the threat of open violence in Washington, D.C., in a contest over control of the U.S. military, and it seemed likely that there's all these resonances with this moment. It seemed likely that sympathetic governors might send the National Guard into Washington, or that the president might try to replace the U.S. colored troops, the black soldiers in the Capitol, with white soldiers. Congress moved to impeach that night and passed the impeachment before it had actually drafted the articles. It ratified the articles a week later. It felt it necessary to send an immediate message that the president's conduct was unacceptable and would justify his removal. The trial then dragged in the Senate, and I suspect it will drag here as well, although it does not have to. It is not a criminal process. But the Senate can act, but even if it doesn't act in the next 8 days, even if it doesn't reconvene until the 19th, as now seems likely, there is still value in carrying the process through to its end. You want to be able to draw a line for future presidents so that they know that inciting a mob to storm the Capitol is behavior that will result in their own impeachment and trial. And potentially, if you can find 67 senators, or actually at the moment it would be 66 senators, willing to remove the president from office, you can certainly find 51 who would bar him from a future office. And it might relieve the country of the spectacle of President Trump trying to get a second non-contiguous term in 2024.
Why are those two numbers different? Why is 155, you said, that would bar him from future office, and the other 66 that would signal indictment of the charge of impeachment?
So this is down into the constitutional weeds a little bit.
Yeah, I haven't heard this before.
So the framers wanted to set the bar for impeachment and removal quite high. Impeachment takes a majority in the House. Removal takes a two-thirds majority in the Senate. That's an extraordinary bar to clear. We've never actually cleared it. And I think that it's important for all of us to remember that we may not clear it here either. It would take 66 senators at the moment because there are 99 United States senators. When they swear in the two newly elected senators from Georgia, it would take 67. But once the Senate has done that, there is a clause in the article that addresses impeachment which says that the Senate can, if it chooses, bar somebody who has been removed from office from holding any future office in the United States. And since it does not specify the number of votes it would take to do that, that is widely interpreted to be something that requires only a simple majority of the Senate.
So the impeachment itself would not in any way preclude Donald Trump running again in 2024 for president of the United States.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's designed to remove him from office in the moment. But unless the Senate takes a subsequent vote to bar him, the impeachment, the simple impeachment would not, and the removal would not bar him from, neither the impeachment nor the removal on their own would bar him from running again in 2024.
President Trump spoke this morning and said that, in effect, what he was saying on the night of the riot that descended on the Capitol was totally appropriate. That there was nothing wrong with it, that in fact, more should have been done about the violence that occurred in Portland, Oregon, rather than what happened at the Capitol. What do you make of that? Is he still in that place where he believes what he did was totally appropriate?
It's very hard for me to put myself into the mind of Donald Trump, but I think I can accurately describe at least his behavior. Through his career, both in business and in politics, he has generally tried to brazen everything out. The last time he was impeached by the House of Representatives, it came because of a call that he made with the leader of Ukraine. And in some sense, the impeachment only arose because the transcript of that call was hidden. There was an implicit acknowledgement in the fact that all of his aides tried to cover up the call, that they all understood it to be deeply wrong. And President Trump's response as that scandal unfolded was to try to own it, to describe it as a perfect call, the best phone call, And I think that's what you're seeing again now, that in general, Trump has understood that in American politics, most Americans, most voters, don't follow this stuff closely. They look for cues. They look for signals. They employ heuristics. If you see a politician apologizing for something, trying to cover it up, trying to minimize it, that's an implicit admission of guilt. If you see a politician proudly proclaiming something, announcing it at his rallies, that means that they are proud of it and have not done anything wrong. And Trump has leaned hard into that approach by always, always, always owning his misconduct, bragging about what he's done. You know, he's the kind of man who will sit in the back of a bus and brag about sexual assault. He has always understood that the things you brag about are not the things you are held accountable for. And so I think that's what we're seeing again now, is that at a moment where his presidency is again on the line, where his future is on the line, his intuitive response is to try to own the misconduct, to boast about the misconduct, and to convince people that if it was actually problematic, he wouldn't be boasting. And so the fact that he is boasting must mean that it was fine.
For those people who were watching on television what was unfolding on Capitol Hill, do you think any minds were changed? Any thoughts about support of Donald Trump and those who support him by going to the Capitol and creating mayhem? Do you think any minds were changed by those actions?
Well, I think we have some evidence that some minds were changed. There were senators and congressmen who were trying to throw out the results of our Democratic election who abandoned those efforts subsequent to the riot. Not most of them, I should add, but some. And we've had some public opinion polling in the last 48 hours that suggests a small erosion in President Trump's support. He has now perhaps the support of a third of the public. But he has the support of a third of the public after what happened on Wednesday. I think that for committed Trump supporters, like Americans who are committed to almost any ideological movement, when you encounter something that causes you to question your priors, you may waver for a moment. You may stand there and think, gosh, that's not what I expected. But very quickly, a bunch of coping strategies come into play. You can blame somebody else for the unpleasant thing that you are watching. And we've seen the president's supporters do that, that they have, the president himself has reportedly suggested that maybe it was Antifa that stormed Capitol Hill. He suggested this to House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who had to tell the president, you know, no, I was there. They were attacking me. I saw who they were. So that's one coping strategy that you can employ. A second is to try to set the problematic behavior that you've seen in some sort of comparative context that minimizes it. And the president has done this too. He's pointed to Portland, as you mentioned. He said, maybe what the right did was bad, what the left did was worse. That's a second coping strategy that you'll see folks employ. And the third is to flip the spectrum of victimization around. And this you've seen a lot of congressional Republicans do in the last 48 hours. When they are finally facing some of the consequences for their disgraceful behavior, they frame that facing of consequences as victimization. They suggest that the mob is coming for them and it will come for their supporters. And they encourage their supporters to think of themselves as the real victims. We know that white evangelical Christians tell pollsters that the group in America that faces the greatest degree of discrimination is not Hispanic Americans, it's not African Americans, it is evangelicals. It is tempting in our contemporary age for every group to think of itself as the ultimate victims. And given that many of Trump's supporters are primed to think of themselves in those terms anyway, many are quickly reinterpreting the events of last Wednesday as somehow being about their own victimization rather than their own culpability.
And yet, as of now, we've heard that seats of power all over the country are being threatened leading up to the inauguration of Joe Biden. 15,000 National Guard members are going to be assigned to the District of Columbia alone. Is that going to be enough, Yoni?
Oh, God, I hope so. In fact, I hope that it's entirely unnecessary. I hope that we do not see Americans spilling the blood of other Americans again as we did last Wednesday. We face a fairly horrifying moment, and I want to pin responsibility for this exactly where it belongs. If it were the case that an election were being stolen, if there was a dark conspiracy involving pedophilia or secret violence to subvert the government of the United States, you would expect patriots to do something about it. And so in some sense, although certainly anyone who has bought into the various conspiracy theories that are circulating, anyone who does that is accountable for their own actions. The political leaders who have lied to their constituents, who have bolstered the belief that this election was stolen, who have refused to tell the truth, at their feet lies the bloodshed of Wednesday and any potential bloodshed on Inauguration Day. It is the most basic responsibility of any elected official to tell their constituents the truth. And we have a shockingly large number of members of Congress who instead are lying to their constituents. They are encouraging them to believe that a terrible conspiracy is taking away their own political power, that their futures are on the line. They have spent years hyping the notion that losing an election is an existential threat that cannot be tolerated, that the consequences are too horrific to contemplate. When you tell your constituents that, and then when you lie to them about what has happened, it is almost inevitable that violence will result. And I pray to God that more violence won't result. But I think that until those politicians start telling their constituents the truth, we have to brace for it.
But as Trump's own power declines, what happens to those members who continue to lie to their constituents?
I wish I could tell you that that course of action will not be rewarded. I wish I could sit here today and tell you with confidence that these people will be shunned, that their constituents will hold them accountable, that they will lose their elections and struggle to find employment. I don't think that's what will happen. The president remains tremendously popular in our highly polarized country within the districts from which these congressmen and senators hail. They are doing what they are doing in part because they fear that the president's continuing hold over those voters, and in part because the deeper malaise into which the president has tapped and the flames that he has fanned will rage on after he is gone from the political scene. And they understand that. And so there is a craven, cowardly, narrow pursuit of self-interest in some of this lying. And I think that it is quite likely that they will persist in these lies for some time, so long as it is to their political advantage to do so. I just wish that they would reckon with the consequences. I wish that now that the violence has arrived on their own doorstep, now that it is hitting their own colleagues, some of them will pull back from the abyss and question what they have done.
Yoni, I want to go back to the language of the impeachment itself. Is it true that last-minute changes were made late Sunday to include a reference to the 14th Amendment, the post-Civil War era addition to the Constitution that prohibits anyone who engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States from holding future office?
So there were several draft articles of impeachment that circulated on the Hill. The one that the caucus seems to have settled on does reference the 14th Amendment, which some of the earlier drafts did not. But it's a little bit cute about how it gets there. It cites the 14th Amendment prohibiting any person who has, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States from holding any office under the United States. It does not, however, say that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection. It does not suggest that the 14th Amendment bars him from holding office. So it cites it more in terms of a general principle that can be applied to the president's conduct than a specific allegation that he needs to be removed from office because he has triggered the 14th Amendment. I think it's a really interesting legal claim that there are ways in which the Reconstruction era amendments, which remade American democracy, really we live with a constitution that's not 200 years old, it's 150 years old, that the Reconstruction amendments turned American democracy into the birthright of every American, into the foundation of a multiracial democracy. And they really almost immediately were pared back by the Supreme Court. Their original meaning was gutted, and they did much more to expand the rights of corporations in the late 19th century than they did to secure the rights of ordinary Americans as the dark night of Jim Crow descended across the South. The original meaning of the 14th Amendment probably does apply to exactly what Donald Trump was trying to do here, not just because of the racial valence of that mob, but also because he was attempting to use violence in order to subvert the duly elected government of the United States. On the other hand, the Supreme Court has turned its back on those meanings for 150 years, and it's a little hard for me to imagine the Supreme Court now applying the 14th Amendment. But it is significant that it's there in the article. It is a way of Congress saying, look, these are American values that we have ratified before, that we have enforced before, and we ought to be enforcing today.
Of course, the American people were also watching the president and his family, watching his son's girlfriend dancing as she saw what was happening, cheering, going up. I mean, how much farther do you have to go to prove that the president was not only in support of, but condoning what was happening on Capitol Hill?
You know, there's a parallel here to the Ukraine case in that the president's defenders are not actually defending his conduct. In that widely circulated video taken inside the tent just before Trump takes the stage at the rally, as his son and supporters are in a jubilant mood, just before Trump will go out there and call on that crowd to go up to Capitol Hill, you can see that there is a heedless disregard of the potential consequences. We have reporting from the Washington Post and other outlets that as this unfolded, President Trump was unwilling to intervene. He was unwilling to call on that crowd to be peaceful. Longtime supporters of the president were on the phone literally begging him to do something. They are now rushing to leak their accounts to the press so that they are not held responsible for what unfolded. But I think we can credit some of those accounts, that they seem to be saying that the president was mostly alarmed that these rioters might interfere with the stonewalling that his supporters on the Hill were already engaged in, and that he was delighted by their expression of support, delighted by the chaos that he had caused. There's very little question that he could have done more to suppress this, even if he hadn't anticipated it, and that he chose not to do so for hours as the violence raged. I can't think of a more direct dereliction of responsibility. This is a man who has sworn to uphold and faithfully discharge the Constitution and the laws of the United States. There's nobody on Capitol Hill who is making the argument that he fulfilled that responsibility. The most you'll get is people saying it would be divisive to pursue this. This isn't the proper remedy for this moment. But just as in Ukraine, in the initial phase at least, very few of the president's supporters are willing to look at what he did and actually defend it on the merits, and that matters.
And with just 8 days left in office, couldn't many legitimately argue he's going to be gone? Let's just move on. Let's get Joe Biden into office and put Trump behind us. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, it's a compelling argument. And in many ways, it is of a piece with the way that Democrats have approached this presidency from the beginning. They have always hoped that something would arrive to deliver them from the curse of Donald Trump. Perhaps it would be Robert Mueller's investigation. Maybe it would be a criminal probe in New York City or something that they could get a hold of his tax returns and that would force him. You know, they've always looked for the thing that would relieve them of the responsibility for acting. And now they have it, right? In 8 days, he'll be gone anyway. But I think you have to step back and consider the pattern of behavior that the president has exhibited over the last 3 months. Having lost a free and democratic election, he refused to concede. He did his best to cast doubt on the results. He called and pressured, exerted extreme pressure on state election officials in order to falsify the returns, exposing them and their families to the violence of his supporters. And then when he was unable to pressure legislative leaders to intervene, unable to get the judges that he had appointed to throw out the results of a fair election, unable to get the state elections officials to act, he summoned violent supporters to Washington and encouraged them to walk up Capitol Hill and give Congress a piece of their mind. If the president is allowed to leave on January 20th with no consequence for that pattern of behavior, it is an open invitation to any future president to act in precisely the same way. And I don't know how you avoid this by simply pretending it didn't happen. I don't know how you stave off a recurrence that way.
What about the opposing argument that impeaching him or removing him will simply incite more people to riot violently?
I'm reminded of the bully who looks down at you scornfully and says, I just hit you once, don't make me hit you again. The riot has told us that this is not a theoretical threat, right? That there is violence being used in order to shape the decisions of legislators. They are telling reporters that their votes are being shaped by the fear of what will happen to themselves and their families back in their districts. We are at the point where there is an existential threat being posed to American democracy. Lawmakers are casting their ballots in fear of the violence if they acted as they knew the right thing to do would be. I don't think you can walk away from that. I wish that this was not a divisive process. I don't think impeachment should be a divisive process. I would urge every House Republican and every Senate Republican to heal this nation and bring us back in unity by fulfilling their constitutional duty. It is the refusal of Republicans to hold a president who has directly attacked the Congress to account that is dividing the nation. It is not the efforts of Democrats to do the same that is divisive.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Joni Applebaum, senior editor at The Atlantic.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Joni Applebaum, senior editor at The Atlantic. When you think about what could happen on Inauguration Day, what's your worst fear?
My worst fear is that we see not a recurrence of what took place last Wednesday, which was a confluence of factors that led to an unanticipated riot, but rather that some of the president's most hardcore supporters, conspiratorial groups, militias, choose to act in an overtly violent fashion because they fear what will happen should the duly elected president be allowed to take office. That's my worst fear, that they feel empowered and emboldened by what happened on Wednesday. They crossed the Rubicon. Violence was openly employed to overturn an election. Dozens and dozens of Republicans in Congress voted to overturn an election, and there were no consequences. The president still holds office. Very few people to date have been arrested, and most of the charges so far filed against them are minimal. Most of those rioters, even after police had established a perimeter around the Capitol, were encouraged to and allowed to simply walk away. And given that that's the case, I deeply fear that many people who are predisposed to militancy and violence will conclude that they can act with impunity. And unless we impose consequences, that is my worst fear for the weekend around Election Day, that starting on the 17th, we will see people push this further and try to exploit the perception of impunity to act in a way that causes Americans to shed the blood of other Americans.
And of course, on Inauguration Day, at least before President-elect Biden is sworn in, President Trump says he will not even be at the inauguration. Should violence break out, whose responsibility will it be to call out even more National Guard?
So the inauguration has now been designated a national security event. The Secret Service is the lead agency in coordinating the response, and it actually has the authority to direct the department, not to request, but to direct that the Department of Defense pull out more guard troops or other forces in support of the government of the United States. We are fortunate that in the main, government agencies, career civil servants, and sworn military officers have behaved tremendously responsibly over the last 4 years. It's a little horrifying to think about a government that relies on that in order to adhere to the rule of law. But in this moment, I think most Americans can take comfort that what we're talking about is sworn, trained career professionals who are deeply devoted to the rule of law and the cause of constitutional government, who will be charged with protecting not just President-elect Biden and Vice-President-elect Harris, but all of the leaders of government who gather and the ordinary citizens. I think the one thing that has been somewhat overshadowed is that the life that was lost on Capitol Hill was a Capitol Police officer, a supporter of President Trump, who showed up and did his job, who did his duty and paid for it with his life. That many people who work on Capitol Hill are just ordinary Washingtonians. You know this, Diane, that there are cafeteria workers and janitors and a host of just ordinary folks who go up there, serve with tremendous pride, are proud to be up there on Capitol Hill, proud to play a role in American government. But that's who was subjected to violence on Wednesday. It's not just about the lawmakers. It's about everybody who lives in this city.
How concerned are you about the president's last 8 days in office as to what he might do to somehow create havoc in the land?
I'm extremely concerned, and I'm concerned at two different and contradictory levels. I'm worried about what President Trump may do. We have seen that that he is heedless of the consequences of his acts, and that often the worst things that he does are delivered in the language that a mafia boss would use. He indicates to his supporters, he indicates to his aides a general direction in ways that don't offer them a specific set of instructions that don't constitute an order. But often he does his most repugnant things by signaling the way he wants things to work out. Right now, he continues to signal that he would like to find a way to stay in power. And people are listening to that. And that's tremendously worrying. The other level I worry about, frankly, is I worry about the future of a constitutional government in which people can simply ignore the president of the United States. We have increasing indications that that's what's actually happening within the executive branch at the moment. And that shift is in fact being encouraged by leaders like Nancy Pelosi, who reached out to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, America's highest ranking military officer, to encourage him to effectively remove President Trump from the nuclear chain of command. These things may be necessary to get us through the next 8 days, but they are not healthy. They are a result of an impossible choice that President Trump has forced upon us. Constitutional officers can either listen to the duly elected president and by listening to him, betray their responsibilities. Or they can ignore the duly elected president and by ignoring him, betray their oaths. That's a terrible choice that President Trump has forced on us. And whatever happens in the next 8 days, I fear that we will be dealing with the consequences of those decisions for a long time.
Are you suggesting that Nancy Pelosi should not have made the request to the Joint Chiefs of Staff to ignore an order by President Trump during these last 8 days to, for example, God forbid, launch a nuclear missile, attack another country while he has the power?
We know that discussions like that took place in Nixon's last days. We know it now. They were conducted very quietly for a variety of reasons, including to safeguard the security of the United States and not give aid or comfort to our enemies. His aides were tremendously concerned about Nixon's instability. He descended into drink in those last days. Whether or not you think that discussion is appropriate to have, I don't see what purpose is served by making it public, by putting it out in a press release, by briefing her members on it. There are sometimes very difficult conversations that need to take place. If this one needed to happen at all, it certainly didn't need to be broadcast in the way that it was. And I'm concerned about the lasting damage to civil-military relations that it entails. It probably is the first time that I can recall a congressional leader calling on a leader of the U.S. military to ignore the president. I fear it won't be the last. And when you do these things publicly, that there are long-term consequences. I certainly understand why she acted as she did, but I worry about the ramifications.
You're saying had she done so privately and kept it private, it would have been more acceptable?
I think if she had done so, if she felt that this was a conversation that she needed to have and had done so privately, I think it would have limited the damage of the act. In general, I don't think that congressional leaders should be trying to tinker with the military chain of command. There is a constitutional mechanism for dealing with a president like this. If we're genuinely concerned that the person in the Oval Office may start a nuclear war, there are ways to act. And the speaker has not been swift to bring articles of impeachment back to the floor. She had that phone call before she'd even committed to doing that. It's hard for me to understand how somebody who has the capacity to remove a president from office would choose to employ end runs that way before she's tried everything that she can.
Yoni, what do you think of the calls for the resignations of Senators Hawley and Cruz?
I think that the Senate has always policed its own membership, and that so far, at least, those two senators are unrepentant. They have not acknowledged responsibility. They have not atoned for what they did. And it's difficult for me to understand how people are going to sit in that chamber side by side with colleagues who were willing to lie to their constituents, extend false hope, and help incite a mob that almost cost them their lives. You know, it's ultimately for the Senate to decide who should be seated there. But I would think that at the very least, Senators Hawley and Cruz owe their colleagues a tremendous apology for their conduct. And it's hard for me to see how they can continue to serve in the United States Senate if they're not willing to at least do that.
Back in early 2019, you argued forcefully for Trump's first impeachment, and that did come about, but didn't seem to make much difference in his actions or his behavior. If he is impeached a second time, do you believe it will make a difference?
We have an unbroken streak in American history. No president who has ever been impeached has seen his party hold on to the Oval Office in the next presidential election. President Trump extends that streak. Congressional Democrats had been saying for years that he was unfit, but had refused to act on it. And then they acted on their conscience, and they sent a clear message to the American public that this man was not fit for office. I wish the Senate had behaved as responsibly. I wish that the Senate had a real trial. I wish that it had heard from the relevant witnesses instead of treating it as a foregone conclusion. There are many reasons to be concerned about President Trump's fitness for office. I think that the pandemic has focused all of us on the tremendous risk that we run when we leave a chief executive in power who cannot discharge basic responsibilities. I wonder how many Americans would be alive today who have perished in the past year if we had a president who was capable of holding the office. And I think that this time, too, whatever the impact of impeachment on President Trump's behavior, the larger principle is one worth adhering to, that if Congress takes its responsibility seriously, if it tells the American people that somebody is not fit for office, there are benefits. There are benefits to following the rule of law. There are benefits to replying to an attempt to turn to violence, to reject the rule of law by reasserting in a hopeful and optimistic way our ordinary and regular constitutional processes. And ultimately, that's what impeachment is. It's a defiant assertion in the face of mob violence that the system can work, that it can police itself, that we have ways of dealing with extraordinary situations that don't require mobs storming the Capitol.
Finally, Yoni, what are your best and worst thoughts about the early days of President-elect Biden's term in office?
I'm tremendously encouraged that the new administration is putting vaccination at the top of its priority list. It's going to try to do what we need to do to solve two problems, to reopen our economy and alleviate the tremendous economic suffering that's out there, and also to stem the tide of death. That's the right priority. But Joe Biden faces a very difficult challenge. He ran as a restorationist candidate. He promised us the return of normalcy. Well, normalcy didn't work for a tremendous number of Americans. It didn't work for those who face racial injustice in their daily lives. It did not work for those who have faced economic displacement and lost their jobs or their industries in recent decades. It doesn't work for Americans who are facing a yawning chasm of economic inequality that has only accelerated. It won't be enough to go back to where we were before Trump. And so I think that there's a challenge for this administration, and it's a bipartisan challenge for Congress as well. How do we craft a society that lets every American live up to their potential? There's a lot of potential answers out there. The only thing that I know for sure is that returning to what we did prior to Donald Trump is not enough. And so I think that the challenge that Biden faces is he capable of summoning the will to act, of getting things through Congress, of taking executive actions on his own that can help restore the promise of America? Ultimately, that is the antidote to what we saw on Wednesday. In a country where people feel lifted up, in a country where they see themselves and their children as having a better future than they enjoy at present, then that expanding pie allows us to cut generous slices for every American. If they think that pie is shrinking, they start fighting over the scraps that remain. And so that's Biden's challenge, is how does he make the pie grow again?
Yoni, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Yoni Applebaum, senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the ideas section. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay safe, be well. I'm Diane Rehm.